It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. And this is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we are here on this, again, absolutely stellar Northeast Florida day. I just cannot believe it. I was telling Jeremy on the way in, the reason I'm in such a good mood is that every day I go outside expecting that it's going to be over now and it'll be hot and humid for the rest of ever and all that. And it's just gorgeous every morning, every day. I'm loving every minute of it. No complaints. Probably even better than the weather in Wisconsin these days. You never know.
Okay.
Maybe. Whatever. Anyway, we are here again, as I say, as usual, and we will be talking for the next hour or so, welcoming everybody. If you're a regular listener, welcome back. Thanks for always being there. You know, we count on you. And if you're new to the show, whether you happened upon it or you left your radio on or somebody told you or whatever, then try to stick around for the whole hour and we promise you'll learn something. And it will be exactly what we want you to learn unless you intervene. And all you have to do, anybody out there, just pick up the phone, dial 904-222-8255, and you will be put on air and we will discuss what you would rather discuss. So use it. We will, of course, have a trivia question they'll give out right after the first break. Another reason that we're kind of in a good mood today, too, was we've been on a kind of losing streak on the market lately. And this week, some things, they didn't actually happen, but they were thought to be happening. And the market was very relieved and showed it for a couple of days. So we came through with a lot of green showing and from there, I'll let Adam pick.
Yeah, it's not that we haven't really been in a bad streak. I mean, the only one that's been bad has been the Dow.
Yeah.
The Nasdaq has actually been on a real tear. So I would disagree with the
boring
being in a down streak. But there's a lot of worries out there. We've got the worry of a recession. We've got the worry of the Fed raising rates too much, which they may have already done. We've got the debt ceiling debate going on. We've got China and Russia and just a host of other things. But this week was very positive as the S&P and the Nasdaq clearly broke their long-term downtrends and what can only be considered a very positive chart pattern. So that was exciting to see. They both put in a series of higher highs and higher lows. And despite the pullback on Friday afternoon, the Nasdaq managed to hit a new 52-week high, and the S&P managed to hit a new year-to-date high, all of this being driven by growth stocks, mostly in technology. Despite technology doing very well, there were some other areas of the market that did not do as well. Energy pulled back over 6% just this week, and real estate and utilities were down about 3.5%. Despite seeing a few big losers, the S&P put together a nice gain of 1.6%, but it lagged the Nasdaq, which was up 3%, and then the Dow, as has been the case all year, lagged once again, gaining just 0.4%. Communication services and consumer discretionary were the other two sectors of the S&P that had good weeks. They gained over 2.5%. Outside of the U.S., Brazil continues to gain momentum. It saw an upside of almost 6% this week, which I do not understand where that's coming from, considering they are headed down a socialist path. Very odd. China and Hong Kong have been struggling, losing 3 and 5% respectively. On the other side, there's Mexico, which has been absolutely on fire this year. It's crazy. Mexico has gained another 2.5% this week to bring its year-to-date gain to over 26%. Japan has been on a bit of a good streak lately, too, and it tacked on another 3.5%. France and Germany both have gains of over 18% this year, but pulled back slightly this week, as did most of Europe. Overall, international stocks were flat on the week, while emerging markets were down slightly.
Do you know what year Japan's market was last as high as it is today?
Well, right before stagflation kicked in, probably, I don't remember exactly, but I'd say we're coming up on 30 years.
That's not bad. 1990. It's been 33 years.
Yeah.
And still, if you go back into 1989, when the peak actually happened, you're probably too young to remember, and a lot of people out there listening will remember, there was an asset bubble in the 80s in Japan. And that's when, for instance, Charles Schwab sold his company to a Japanese outfit for $800 million, and then the market crashed and bought it back for $400 million. And those are numbers I can do real quick in my head. But everything kind of collapsed on them. But in 89, when it peaked, it was still 20% higher than it is today, even though this is the highest it's been in 33 years.
Wow.
That was a crash.
That's a big crash.
And they fought it with the ZERP, the zero interest rate and all that, and the negative interest rate. They did everything wrong, but finally something's working.
Well, and it still remains one of the most expensive places in the world to live, and you've seen some of the crazy, like, hotels for business travelers, which are literally just a bed and a sleeping pod.
A tube.
The real estate.
And the population's
so expensive.
Imploding.
They're basically dying as a country. Yeah. Their population gets smaller every year.
It will cease to exist unless they do something about their xenophobia or their birth rate.
Yep, it's true.
Or both, preferably.
Yep.
But it's so expensive, apparently, to raise children there that people are very reluctant to have kids.
Yeah, it makes sense, though. Do you want to have a kid if you live in a 200-square-foot apartment?
Well, let the population drop another few million, and you'll see some deflation.
Yeah, things will change one way or another, for sure. Mainly due to the drop in oil, commodities had a rough week. Oil dropped over 5%, but that didn't help. But silver also dropped by 4.5%. The one commodity that really helped things this week was the most unlikely suspect, natural gas. Natural gas is still down 45% this year, but it was up 9% this week. Pretty crazy to have a 9% week and still be down 45%.
It's been nuts. I was happy to see it, though. The level it was getting down to was as crazy as the level it got up to.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when things get overheated.
You're supposed to find a level where people can make money in the industry but not go crazy and force consumers out of the industry. And this one has been on both sides of that, all within the last year.
Yeah, definitely. Even really in the last 9 months or so. Fixed income had a rough week as interest rates climbed, something we haven't seen very much of lately. The 10-year yield started the week under 3.5% and saw a pretty much a straight climb to end the week just under 3.7%. That affected every form of fixed income, with TLT, the long treasuries ETF, down over 4%, while AGG, the aggregate bond market, was down almost 1.5%. Much of this probably goes back to fears of an additional rate hike, because the Fed people were out speaking this week, and that never goes well, as we know. I don't think another Fed hike is completely off the table, but I do find it fairly unlikely. So I've got some
the market, they say, the futures market is pricing in a 40% chance of a June increase.
Right now, but that's going to change a lot.
I think so, too.
I feel like that would be, even for this Fed, that would be a bit over-aggressive.
Yeah, and I think we're in a position where you're starting to see some re-juxtaposition in the yield curve, and that may or may not continue going, but if it does, it's tentatively better news for the economy.
How can you have this many recessionary signs and then the Fed continue to hike rates? They'd have to be, as stupid as they are.
Once in a while, I try to think of something and I can't yet. A little more on this and much more to come right after the break. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we do have the trivia question, as usual, brought to you by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. Well, Adam mentioned a few minutes ago that it's not been a real good time in the commodities market lately. There's some exceptions, of course, there always is. One being good for Florida, the orange juice market is the leader among all the commodities, and it's up 24.7 degrees, or degrees, you know, that little percentage mark thing, 24.7% this year. What commodity is second only to orange juice in price increase this year? I'll tell you by how much. You don't have to do that, but you can guess if you get it right. So anyway, let's wrap up a little more. We did see some things that are other things in the market that are interesting, maybe. And part of it is because there's still this, what I think is a very unreasonable fear of, a very unreasonable fear of not raising the debt limit and defaulting on our debt. And you know, I've been around this block a few times. Most of you have, I'm sure. It isn't going to happen. It is one of those things that if a politician were to allow that to happen, and the bigger you are, the harder you fall, if you get my gist, that politician would be unelected so fast and possibly impeached for what it would do to our credit. It's not going to happen. In the parlance of the D.C. elected class, it's called positioning and brinksmanship. And each side is so sure they can win that when they find out that it's minutes away and that they can't win, they give in. And it will either be a patch that lasts a little while or a fix. It is not going to happen. All these headlines you see, oh, the market could drop 20% if we default. Yeah, a lot of things could happen that would cause the market to drop 20%. This is not one that I want people out there worrying about. It is a tempest in a teapot, period. It's just politics.
It's a way for each side to blame the other side for something that isn't going to happen, but sounds really scary.
Yeah, to prevent. It doesn't prevent. I know. You know what I'm trying to say.
Well, it's just.
It's accusation.
It's Biden saying, well, these Republicans won't do what I want them to do. And the Republicans in Congress saying, this moron president won't do what we want him to do. And so, I mean, it's really a stalemate, and like you said, and then they realize that they're both going to lose if they let it happen, and they'll pass, my guess is, a patch and then a deal.
Yeah, because like it or not, we're already in the next election season.
Yeah, yeah. It would not be good for Biden. It would not be good for any sitting Republican or Democrat Congress person. It's not going to happen.
And I do think, from a politically strategic point, that McCarthy did a good job. Here it is. Passed it, laid it on the table. Now, what you say?
Yeah, because the Biden stance initially was, we're not even going to talk to them.
Exactly.
But which is all posturing,
of
too.
Of course.
But, yeah. But
the problem with him
is, he didn't think that McCarthy could get a bill through, and he did.
The problem with Biden is pretty obvious.
What's that?
Well, basically whatever he thinks is wrong.
Isn't that all politicians?
I've got one of my articles in my stack of stuff. I just read the caption on it every once in a while. It says, Biden keeps finding new ways to fail.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Pretty much true.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't want anybody really wasting a lot of time, effort, and sleep and all that on the debt limit. I'd much rather have people think seriously about the inflation itself, what to do about it. And we keep getting asked, how do people hedge this? You know, what if you think something really bad's about to happen, what do you do? And we have been actually giving that answer quite a bit lately because the market changed, interest rates changed. And if you're feeling like you want 30, 40, 50% of your money on the sidelines looking in, you don't have to accept 0% for it anymore. Out of making us all kinds of money in the T-bills and the money markets now. So, yeah, if you want to do something like that, there are lots of ways to do it.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful time to be back in a 60-40 or a 50-50 mm-hmm. portfolio because you can get half of it guaranteed at about 5%. And then the other half, if the market continues like it is, the market's up 8% already this year. You could easily see a 16% year. I mean, you don't know. It could drop down to 0% year. But the fact is, if you just have half your money at risk and a guaranteed 5% return on the other side, those range of possible outcomes look pretty good.
I have actually some statistics on that. If you look back in history, the Dow or the S&P is up about 9% as of right now. There have been, since 1987, there have been 53 times that the Dow or that they measured the increase in the S&P up to now, and 24 of 28 times that it was up 5% or more, it went on to do even more, and it's an average of another 5%. So if history is a guide, which is all it ever can be, it can't be a prediction, it can only be a guide, the rest of this year in the S&P 500 is very likely to be very good.
To be up, yeah.
And I think it just kind of figures because look at last year. Last year was so miserable. The market doesn't like to stay down forever.
Yeah, that's true. And if you're looking for a reason that stocks might rally, consider bullish sentiment. As we all
know. Yeah, exactly.
Individual investors almost always get it wrong. That's if you listen to the show, you know that. It's a contrarian indicator. So bullish sentiment sits at lows we haven't seen since 1987. Only 20% of investors are bullish right now. And 1 year investor confidence is sitting at a record low. Unfortunately for all those individual investors, this is going to be a good thing for the market.
Yeah,
it should be.
It should be when people start coming back in. One more little thing on that optimistic front I was just talking about. Of the years where the S&P was not up to 5% up through this particular day in May, 57% of the other times, it also was positive the rest of the year, but by less, it's only 3.2%. So if you look at all those statistics, this year would be remarkable if it closed up anything but pretty solid, or if it closed down, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not putting it out of the range of possibilities, but it's probably on one of the tails.
Yeah. So, but I think there's plenty of reason out there for optimism. Don't get crazy.
No. But one important economic report we saw this week was retail sales. It was a big miss on the headline. Mm-hmm. However, misses are not always bad. The market is looking for reasons that the Fed may not hike rates again next month, and this report gives them a little bit of incentive for that. The expectation was for an increase of 0.8%, but instead we saw an increase of half of that, 0.4%. The year-over-year change in retail sales is now up just 1.6%. Hard to believe with the demand we've seen recently.
And those are nominal or real numbers?
That's the real number. The core, it does not include. No, those numbers would include inflation.
Yeah, they would.
Yeah, they would. So that's actually probably down.
So on a quantitative basis, people are buying less stuff.
Right. Well, people are buying less stuff, and I want to get to that in a minute. Core GDP, which excludes the volatile categories of autos, building materials, and gas stations, was up 0.6%. It is up 5.2 year over year. So that is more in line with the inflation numbers, but it basically means that sales are flat and people are paying more for what they're buying in the core group of goods. But one interesting thing in this report was that it clearly shows the recent trend of consumers shifting away from buying goods at all, and instead they're buying experiences. Bars and restaurant sales rose 0.6% in April and now are up 9.4% year over year. So you can see where people are spending their money. It's not on goods. It's definitely on the services side.
Hmm. Which sort of was a trend. I guess it was more of a millennial trend. Pre-COVID even, that was starting to happen.
Yeah, that is true. People do value experiences more than goods. So travel and taking Instagram photos at cool locations and things like that. That's definitely a trend with the younger crowd, but it's now a trend with everybody. And it's not just travel. It's going out to eat, meeting with friends. And that's a lot of reaction to the post-COVID lockdowns.
Yeah, in fact, Angela Walker was just talking about related things in the previous hour about among the younger people that are getting of that age, only about half of them are thinking they're going to buy a house. And part of the feeling is that they want that extra money to be flexible. They want to travel. They want to do things back to the experiences.
I mean, when I was in my 20s, I felt the same way. So I don't think that's... I mean,
maybe I don't think I was ever in my 20s.
Maybe you missed your 20s.
I think either that or it was just so long ago.
That's fair. You just don't remember it anymore.
That's probably it. Anyway, I have another little point of interest here, too. A record low share of Americans think now is a good time to buy a home. And who could argue that with prices having been elevated so far and interest rates having risen as far as they are? Look for some softening in prices and look for some lower rates eventually.
And yet, home sales remain fairly
solid.
Fairly solid, yeah, especially here in Jacksonville.
Yeah, the all real estate is local thing, like all politics is local. I don't think I've ever seen it more true than it is right now. So if you're living in Florida or want to be, you're still going to pay for the house, no doubt about it. All right, we've got lots more to come in the show. Many topics, plus lines are open. You can give us a call, and we'll take a little break and be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I remind everybody that lines are open, 904-222-8255, where you could take a shot at this particular trivia question. What commodity has experienced the second most price increase this year, exceeded only by orange juice, which was up about 24.7%? What commodity is behind that in second place? I did want to add another little piece of highlight to what we've been talking about with home buying and that sort of thing. Consumer debt has reached another all-time high. And it's not just credit cards, but they are certainly contributing. So the number of people who are not paying their cards off on time is going up. Some people are actually having to live on it. And that, of course, is very, very detrimental to overall demand. And you got to think that these pressures are all going to come together. In fact, I was reading a little bit this morning about where the a lot of people are expecting the inflation rate by summertime to be down in the 3% range. And Adam and I have been forecasting something along that line for some time now. And I think the more all this comes together, you're going to see the Fed be very, very cautious before they do anything stupid. God save the Queen if I'm wrong. Anyway, auto loan delinquencies are higher than the pre-pandemic for people under 40. And the average monthly car payment has jumped to $729. The average new car is $48,008. And most of America cannot afford to buy a new car right at the moment. This tells you a couple of things. There's been a lot of inflation in the car market and everywhere else. But those pesky interest rates, and they just got to give in. And I would dearly love to get to a position again where good news can be accepted and treated as good news. But meanwhile, the confusion goes on. Adam and I were just talking on the break. We were talking for a long time about the magic 250,000 number, where the number of first-time unemployment claim seekers, in other words, how many were laid off, had been historically really, really low for a couple of years. And it was creeping up the last few months. And we kept saying it's closing in on this 250,000 number. Below that, it's not really contractionary and it's not really scary. Well, last week it jumped up, last Saturday, it had jumped up over 250 and ding, 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 you know, the bells go off. So yeah. This week right away, what happens? It drops down again underneath.
But I found this very lightly reported news story for whatever reason. The weekly claims, when it jumped over 250, it had jumped up by 22,000 that week. That was the highest level since October of 2021. It turns out, though, that most of those new claims came out of Massachusetts, where the state labor department said the reported gain was actually a reflection of an increase in fraudulent activity and not necessarily a spike in people filing for unemployment benefits. So now they're investigating this, and it's really cast a doubt on whether or not initial claims actually did jump over 250 last week. And that's a pretty big deal, considering it's a really important number historically, where if claims cross over that level and continue higher, it's a pretty spot-on recessionary signal.
Yeah, policymakers at the very highest level, meaning the ones that influence all of us by their decisions, have certain rules of thumb, and we do report on a bunch of them, and that is one. So if somebody's out there messing with that number and the policymakers get frightened or do something stupid, then it can impact everybody. So we'll try to keep an eye on that. I don't know why it's not being talked about a bunch.
I don't know.
But it hasn't. In fact, I did not know this. Adam brought it up to me in the break, and I did not know this. So it's kind of I hate to use the term scary. Everything's scary these days, but it's intriguing. You don't like to think that anybody could really manipulate things that are that big. Sometimes you're wrong. Ask Sammy, I guess. And speaking of Sammy, the other Sammy, Brinkman, was caught again, I guess. That guy.
What do you mean?
He was stealing luggage stuff again. This guy is a real treat.
Not even worth talking about.
He was in charge of nuclear waste. Come on, people. All right. How many of you out there have a non-fungible token? How many know what they are?
I do not own any NFTs.
An NFT, it was like somebody had to invent something even crazier than digital currency. So mm-hmm. they came up with the NFT, the non-fungible token. And if you want me to explain to you what it is, you're out of luck.
I can explain it.
I can explain some things.
I can explain it. Here.
Well, do.
All right. So if you have a piece of art,
okay,
that art might be on display in a museum for everyone to enjoy. The fact remains that you own that piece of art. Yeah. Well, in the digital world, you can create digital art and you can sell it. And therefore, one person owns the rights to that digital artwork. Now, it can be reproduced and put on every website in America, but only one person will own it. It is a token of ownership that is recorded, I think, on the blockchain that you own that piece of art or whatever this creation is that is digital.
And by the way, I was just reminded by my research department that the actual last name is Brinton for this one.
Yeah, I was going to say that was not. Didn't sound right.
There's too many Sams. No doubt.
Whatever.
Anyway,
but yeah, so that's what an NFT is. It's a digital. It's a way of recording digital ownership of digital assets.
Why do you need it?
Because otherwise, who owns it? It's just, it exists on the internet.
Well, if somebody steals it from you, is there a
way they can't steal it because it's just available. The ownership is still recorded and you own it.
All right. Well, my research on it says you're pretty much spot on. It resides in something called a digital wallet on the device as part of the technology called blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows? So one of my questions to myself is crypto actually money? And according to IRS, no, it isn't. It's property. You know that? So there's an interesting thing going on in the tax world because a lot of people don't know how to treat their crypto transactions because they think of it as money and IRS does not. So you're going to see some kind of major explanations go on in the IRS world of crypto. Did you see the guy that once predicted Bitcoin would be $250,000, who now says it's dead? The government interfered and it's dead.
Oh, it's all the government's fault.
No future.
Fault.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, what was the first thing we said when we got into this whole
Bitcoin thing? You're going to want to tax it.
You know what Ronald Reagan said. If it doesn't move, you subsidize it. If it keeps moving, you tax it, like that. Anyway, let's take it one step further to the NFT. According to dictionary.com, a token is something that represents something else, which can be an object, a feeling, or a fact, or it can serve as evidence or proof. Okay, so far so good, right? Kind of fits in with what you were saying. Now let's look at the other part of that, fungible. And again, from dictionary.com, fungible items can be easily replaced by or interchanged with cash or items of similar value. So let's reverse that and look at non-fungible. That would seem to me to be items that are unable to be replaced with cash or items of similar value. So what genius out there sold that concept to people? You pay your trade value for the thing that you will own, but it will not have any real value and can't be traded for money, food, or items of value.
But it can be. But it can be sold for money. You can sell an NFT.
You can if somebody will buy it.
Well, that's the truth.
But it's not
anything.
but it says it's non-fungible. So if the name non-fungible is true according to these dictionary definitions, it would be untradeable, unsaleable, and worthless. So maybe we got a naming problem. Maybe we have a different kind of problem. Anyway, it just, it now has come up, speaking of taxes, because so many things in this world, you know, that involve your money come to taxes. Some people now are placing NFTs in IRAs. It's a lot of jargon, isn't it? So you want to buy a non-fungible token in an IRA, thinking that it will make a lot of money and it will be tax-deferred or perhaps tax-free, depending on the IRA you use. But IRS restricts IRAs from holding certain types of assets. Collectibles that include art, antiques, rugs, alcohol, stamps, coins, real metals, gems, and other intangibles are specified in the tax code. There are certain exceptions. For instance, you can buy some particular coins, Canadian maple leaves, that sort of thing, that they authorize because they trust them, I guess, and you can put them in your IRA. So now, over the past few years, you've been hearing everywhere, hold real gold in your IRA, and you can keep it at home, and you're safe, and all that stuff. But the problem with that is IRS doesn't agree with that, that you have to have an authorized custodian to hold those things in your IRA. Well, we're starting to overlap that with the NFT now. And what happens if you have an IRA that has an illegal asset in it that is automatically taxable, and if you get to a certain situation where you're self-dealing within your IRA, that goes one step further and you lose the entire tax deferred or tax exempt status of your IRA 100%. So if anybody starts talking to you about NFTs and IRAs, I would either step back or walk away quickly. All right, we'll be right back after the last break. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we will hit the phones without delay. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. How are we on this nice weekend?
Absolutely spectacular. How about you?
Great. Well, hanging in there. I'm always chipper until I watch the hearings from Washington, D.C., like what they did to these FBI whistleblowers. I just found that reprehensible, but
yeah, you're right.
I guess that's for another topic.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Okay, not to waste any time, I'll take a quick shot at the trivia, if I may. I'm going to say rice.
Well, it is a nice guess, but it is not a correct guess.
Okay, all right. I just felt because there seems to be a rice shortage, and 90% of Asia consumes rice,
mm-hmm.
and there's been bad crops, I understand, because of drought in China and Pakistan.
There's a second
rice is in a shortage.
There's a second feature in that, too, in that there are a lot of these green types out there that are trying to curtail the production of rice because of nitrogen or some such thing. You know, it's the planet is much more important to those people than the people who live on it.
I remember years ago going to an exhibit in the American Museum of Natural History about the genetic production. They had just come out with that golden rice that was going to make up for the shortfall. But I haven't heard much about golden rice lately.
But you're right. It's a very necessary commodity to feed the 8 billion people on this planet. Very important.
Absolutely. All right.
We appreciate the call.
Keep up.
Thank
you. Yes, keep up the great work. Take care.
Thank you.
Good morning, Craig.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Good morning, Adam. I finished the book, Milton Friedman's Money Mischief. And you brought up NFTs, and it made me think of his stories about Stone Island, where, you know, everybody had the big round stones, and that was their, you know, how they measured their wealth.
Yep.
And then, of course, he brought back the memories of the Holland.
Tulips.
Yeah, the tulip craze.
Yeah, the tulip bulbs.
Yep. And, the next tulip bulb was priced at above the GDP of the Netherlands. And nobody buy it for some reason.
It's weird.
That is crazy. Let me take a quick stab.
Sure.
Just because of the prices, would it be coffee?
It would be coffee.
Nice.
That's absolutely true.
Yep, it is.
And it is up 14.3%. And that makes it something of a distant second. But in a year where commodities in general are not thriving, that's still pretty good. If
wow.
you're a coffee and OJ drinker,
not so good.
But
not
producers
good
probably having a really good time.
No doubt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I'm sure their costs are up substantially as well.
No kidding. All right, I will put you on hold, and Jeremy will get your stuff, and Adam will send you out a little token of our appreciation, if I might.
Yeah.
Okay.
It won't be non-fungible.
Not an NFT, please.
I think Publix will take it in a heartbeat. All right, thanks for the call. Yeah, for those of us who like both of those commodities, it's kind of a shame. That's life.
Yeah, the coffee thing hasn't stopped us from buying it.
Yeah. And you want some good news?
Sure.
This hits us kind of indirectly, but, some people, if you're in a profession or occupation, you want to keep other people out of it because you don't want the competition. Well, in our business, that is not a good plan. The world is short of people who are trained and do business as we do with the certified financial planners. And we like to encourage people, and you've heard me probably many times, if you're the kind of person who likes people, money, and numbers, this is a great way to make a living, having a good time with some of the nicest people you'll ever meet. Well, you might also know that there's been some changes in the law going around, the tax law, about 529 funds. And now, under certain circumstances, like you have to have open for 15 years and on, but instead of use it or lose it type or pay taxes on it when you take it out type, they're allowing, little by little, they're allowing the 529 to be converted into a Roth IRA over time. So if you're a beneficiary of a 529, but you didn't actually have to use all the funds and you have a little patience, you might wind up with another Roth IRA. But now there's an add-on to that, and it is being touted by the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards. They are now going to allow 529 funds to finance training for CFP credentials. How about that? Not that they're real expensive, but if you've got a CFP in training or somebody who would like to be in the, what are the course now, seven are there?
Yeah.
I think there were six when I was in it.
Is there six, seven plus a final course where you have to present a big.
So it's a little longer, a little more complicated, and therefore, because it's higher education.
It's not insignificant. It costs somewhere in the $3,000 range,
okay.
I believe.
So. Well, I think it's a simple little thing to allow 529 plans to be used for that, but having it specifically written may encourage a few people to go into it. Over time, there are an awful lot of us who are along in years, I might say, and when that starts to go away and these people retire, which I probably won't ever quite do, but we need more people coming up, and it takes quite a while. Even after you have passed the test, it takes quite a while to earn your number, so to speak, because you have to have an adequate amount of experience. But it takes even longer to become really competent at what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my complaints for many, many years was that there's no way to enter this business. Like the old line was, well, first you go get a job and make $1 million and put it in the bank. Then you open up a financial planning business and you spend $1 million while you build up your business and you're back to where you were, except now you're a CFP with a decent business. Well, that's not true anymore. Opportunities to get into this abound now, and it keeps getting better, and that's a good thing. We encourage competition. We just want it to be good competition.
Speaking of which, there's a new fraternity over at UNF. And it is called the Mu Nu Upsilon Fraternity. It uses the abbreviation MNY for short. It started at the University of South Florida. It's now, I don't know if it's actually exists at UNF yet, but it's coming. It's trying to get into Texas Tech, University of Georgia, Kansas State, Arizona State, and UNF. And if you don't know why those universities are all the same, they all offer financial planning degrees. Wow. We are fortunate to have one right here in Jacksonville. If you are interested, it is an excellent program, and you can actually, if your kid is an undergrad and they want to get into financial planning, they can take all the classes while they're in college to graduate prepared to take the CFP exam and become a CFP.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I don't have a lot of time to get into a bunch of things, but there was an article I read this morning I wanted to talk about, and it was a question actually asked of an advisor from an older couple. It says, can a nursing home take our IRA? My wife and I are elderly. We have a $100,000 IRA and a trust to protect our assets. My wife and I are elderly. I have an individual retirement account worth about $100,000. And we have a trust set up through our children to protect our assets. If one or both of us have to go into a nursing home, can they take our IRA? What do we need to do to protect it? This is not a yes or no question by any means. If they are talking about going on to Medicaid and they have a $100,000 IRA, that will preclude them from going on to Medicaid.
But people often wonder if they can get onto Medicaid when they have a bunch of assets, but the right. very definition of Medicaid means that you are out of other options. That's what Medicaid was designed for.
But there are two things you can do if that's what you're thinking. And by the way, you should never even think that unless you know it's inevitable. You don't want to be in a Medicaid sponsored place for the most part. I know there are some good ones.
I've had
reports on them,
but they're also a lot of demand for those places.
Absolutely.
And competition.
But one thing you can do, you can take your assets and buy a Medicaid-qualified annuity. But guess what? The money that comes out of there gets paid to the nursing facility mm-hmm. first. If there's any leftover, you can have it. But the assets transfer. You are no longer the owner of those assets. It's again, kind of a last resort thing if you need it. The other thing you can do, they do not count equity in your house. If you have a mortgage and some money and you're looking to get into Medicaid, you can take that money and put it into paying down your mortgage or paying off your mortgage. But, there's always a but. If you've ever heard of something called the five-year look-back period.
I was going to say, I don't think that that's a good strategy unless you are
terrible strategy.
You know that 6 years from now you're going to need Medicaid.
Now, one thing would qualify. If you just keep making your regular payments on your mortgage, that's fine.
Yes.
But if you accelerate the equity in your home, thinking you're going to get Medicaid to pay your bills within 5 years, you are wrong. And you're going to be very, very disappointed. And once you get that money into the equity in your home and try to get it out again, you're going to fail because nobody's going to give you a mortgage anymore at your age. Be very careful whenever somebody says protect your assets with a trust. If it doesn't say asset protection trust, you probably want to run away instead of walking. All right, we're about done for the day, as happens so frequently. We just kind of get rolling and the hour's over, but we will be back for another one next week at the same time. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the Van Wee Financial Hour.
AM 600 WVOP Jacksonville, 101.1 FM, W266 CX Fruit Cove, WVOP.